Evening, ladies and gentlemen. We'll just wait for Mike Gregory to sit down.
Good evening. It's not often I get a chance to do that. I couldn't resist it. Welcome to our fourth distinguished lecture for the Centre for Science and Policy. A very brief word about the Centre for Science and Policy. We are an organisation set up a little over a year and a half ago, I suppose, to connect up science engineering with policymakers. The point being, as was said in a Council for Science and Technology report in late 2008, that there leaves a lot to be desired in the relationship between the people in the academic community who understand an awful lot about some very interesting stuff and the policymakers who are having to wrestle with some deep and very intractable problems and actually turn that into something that will will work. And our mission is not to bring scientists who will then somehow speak truth unto power. Our mission is to build a network that includes policymakers, scientists and engineers, and for them to have a dialogue based on mutual respect. And I say that absolutely, completely and utterly convinced, because I have myself moved from a position where I have not really quite understood how difficult it actually is being a policymaker and the difficult decisions you have to take and what appears to be, to a scientist and an engineer, a perfectly obvious and rational solution to something, when it encounters what actually happens in policy, is a different matter. And the Centre for Science and Policy has no axes to grind. We have nothing to say specifically to push a particular line. Our job is entirely to build that network, to build that interchange, to make sure that we provide the forum for those people to interact. And there is one particular initiative that I just want to draw your attention to, and that is a thing called our Policy Fellow Scheme. And that is where we are bringing people from government and indeed now from industry into the university, giving them a tour, in effect, intellectual tourism. They can talk to any academic they want to, provided the academic accepts that. And we are building thereby a very strong network within government, which enables those policymakers to tap into the very best in science and engineering, in economics, in law, in philosophy, in politics, and in all the other things that Cambridge University and indeed other universities have to offer. So if you know anybody who's interested in that scheme, please let us know. We are expanding and extending what we are doing there. But one of the other activities is the one that we're here for tonight, and that is to talk about science and policy. And I'm very, very pleased that we've got Dr. Evan Harris and Dr. Julian Huppert. It's very good when you have MPs and ex-MPs with PhDs here this evening. I did have a brief chat with Evan just before this lecture, and we agreed that he was not going to do an hour-long talk on the Euro. He's going to be appearing in the 2011 Geek Calendar playing chess. So, without any further ado, Evan, I'm going to ask you to step up, please, and tell us what you want to tell us.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be. Firstly, I need to explain that I'm a medical doctor. I'm not a real doctor, and I can at least count when I'm outnumbered, and survival instincts kick in. I'm grateful to David for reminding me that I lost narrowly. It's always nice to be reminded, and to be described as an achievement, I think, gives it a sort of status. They say that every cloud has a silver lining, and I just want to let you, many of whom may face disappointments in the future in your careers or personally, that I found that there's no silver lining. And just wanted to be honest about that. And it's incredibly... So I don't know what... I suspect the only thing that's more frustrating than trying to cram 13 years of talking about science and Parliament and evidence-based policy into 22 and a half minutes is trying to... is the only thing that's more difficult than that is to overcome the frustration of recognising how close it was at the election and what could have been. I have been encouraged by a couple of things. There were lots of kind letters and words of support, which I hope to convert into financial support for my new enterprise, so be careful. And it was good to see David Howarth retiring. Sorry, turn the page. David Howarth retiring, but being replaced by Julian Huppert, because David, as many of you know, is both irreplaceable and irreparable. And but it was great to see Julian there, and he now has to... He's got 13 years of my stuff being emailed to him on a regular basis. So what I wanted to do was just talk a little bit about the state of science in Parliament and in policy. And it's not going to be possible to do full justice to this. There's a couple of books in this, actually. But I'm going to give you some examples of what we're dealing with, talk about what has been done on Science and Technology Select Committee in respect of evidence-based policy making, which is significant. I mean, that's one significant change there's been. Talk a little bit about front foot campaigning that we achieved, myself and some allies in Parliament, over the years, which is, again, if we build on that, then we won't be back to square one and we will have clearly made progress. And then say a little bit about what I think we need to aim for inside Parliament, and hopefully Julian will then give his perspective on whether he can achieve that on his own. So one of the questions is it better than before? Do I think the state of the treatment of science as a discipline, or the understanding of science as a discipline, and the role that evidence plays in informing policy, or in some areas where policy is based on evidence, has that got better? And I think only in one sense has it got better, but that is, it's accompanied by greater risks. So, for example, I don't know that we will not see a repeat of some of the little anecdotes I'm going to give you about what ministers got up to, but I suspect we will. So Alan Milburn, I remember saying once, and I've not been able to find the quotation frustratingly, so I think it has to be recognised as unsighted, and possibly therefore apocryphal, but you can picture him saying this and hear it in his accent, that in 3 years' time, he said as Health Secretary, he expected all GPs to perform above average. And I tried to raise concerns about that, but they were not understood. That was what was frustrating. Patricia Hewitt wrote a letter, so I think less of an excuse perhaps, to, I think it was The Independent, and I did find this once, so I'm relatively confident about this, declaring in response to an article that home birth was safe and that the government were commissioning research to prove that. As it happens, that research now has been published and it just does generally support her contention, but the point was not the question of whether there was good evidence for that, but the nature of commissioning, how you commission research and the nature of an equipoise, I think one might call it, in medical, ethical, clinical trial terms. But it's not. This is not a thing of the past. I don't like to speak ill of the living, but we have a parliament, and you can just search on the internet for Nadine Dorries and David Tredinnick. And I'm not going to go into it too much, except the most recent example, because I've now got a bit of time to watch what's going on in Parliament and lament, as opposed to be there and lament. And the MP for Mid-Bedfordshire, in a debate on abortion policy, stated that that there was a report that said that women who had had an abortion were 30% more likely to suffer from serious mental illness. That's a contentious statement in itself, which I won't go into. Her very next sentence was, therefore 30% of women who have an abortion end up with a serious mental illness. It was the next sentence, and I ask you whether it's too much to expect that an increase of a risk should not be converted to an absolute prevalence or incidence rate. It's just astonishing. David Tredinnick, Bosworth, I think, in Leicestershire, Bosworth and Hinckley, has no qualms about saying that he knows that surgeons know that they don't operate during a full moon because the blood doesn't clot. And this was challenged, and he still avers this, and he's got early day motions about the role of homeopathy in the treatment of breast cancer. So there's a lot of work to do there. Got Nick Clegg saying in response to a report from the Institute for Fiscal Studies, which you can disagree with, but what you can't do is say it's utter nonsense. Okay, because if people were to think, Institute for Fiscal Studies published report and assertion by a politician with a vested interest in defending a position, who are they going to support? And I think I hear that was a phrase regretted. But it needs to be critiqued in order that it's prevented, because whoever wrote that line needs to understand that that's going to be counterproductive. Just the other day in the House of Lords, who are not exempt from this, the Home Office Minister, Pauline Neville-Jones, who apparently used to run our intelligence services, said, and I haven't got the exact quote, unfortunately, because I can get back to my office to pick up the Hansard, but said essentially when a question was asked by my colleague, Lord Taverne, about drugs policy following the publication in The Lancet of the work by David Nutt et al. On the relative risks of drugs, including alcohol and tobacco, that basically government was not going to base its policy on mumbo-jumbo science. Okay, and you know, this is in response to a specific question about what was her response to this published paper, and that isn't good enough either. So even that suggests there's a long way to go. But there have been some improvements within the structures. For example, we now have, and the last government needs to get credit for this, a statistics authority and a chairman of that at the moment who is willing to call in or speak out at egregious failures to respect that. And I think Sheila Bird's in this audience, and she'll know that the example of the knife crime statistics, which was a total failure to understand regression to the mean and was a failure, and they don't have to understand that, they just have to check with the people that do before they abuse statistics by premature partisan publication. One might say that over the last 10 years there has been a move towards politicians talking about evidence-based policy, but I am sceptical about whether this is an advance, because there's a huge risk that that term will be used and named and claimed when in fact it's anything but. And that it would be a disaster. It is a disaster if the vocabulary of evidence-based policy is perverted, is misused. Evidence-based medicine is, some of you will know, and as even I learnt before I escaped, or rather before my frustrated colleagues and surviving patients voted me out of that previous job, is a very clear set of principles and rules of practice that, as I say, are clear and set out. And what you can't do is have politicians claiming something is evidence-based when it isn't. And therefore, we need to have robust systems of the treatment of independent scientific advice. And it was extremely frustrating at the end of the last Parliament to see what happened with David Nutt. Because if you analyse exactly what happened there, you will see that he was exercising academic freedom on the one hand, and secondly, reasserting the evidence base, both of which he's entitled to do, and it would be wrong to ask people to give up academic freedom when giving free advice to the government as an expert. And when he was attacked by the newspapers over the paper that he wrote, which was about the difficulty of explaining the risk of drugs, and therefore the need to find analogies and showing that you could make an analogy on risk alone, whether it's accurate or not is not the point, with horse riding. So this was this ecstasy equacy paper. He was attacked by the tabloids, and Jackie Smith, her job was to defend him, yet she just attacked him. I mean, it happened to be the week after she was exposed in the Mail on Sunday on an expenses story, and so it was a useful scapegoat or distraction. But it was her job and that of the Home Office science advisor to support him because he did nothing wrong. Yet she phoned him in the middle of his outpatient clinic to ask him to apologise for publishing a paper in a peer-reviewed journal. Apologised strangely for the insult, not to the bereaved of victims of horse riding accidents, comparing them with ne'er-do-well drug users, but the other way around, which was a curious thing. So it was incoherent and very sad, and we saw what happened with Alan Johnson. And one of the regrets I have about the Science and Technology Committee was that it hadn't matured enough for the Labour members on that committee to allow us to do a proper inquiry and have Nutt, Alan Johnson, Paul Wiles, the science advisor, John Beddington, before us to raise questions about what on earth happened, whereby a lecture which was given months before and then published was used as an excuse to sack someone. And while independent science advisors now fear that they may be sacked, and they now can clearly be sacked if their minister loses trust in them, which is a nebulous subjective feeling, then I don't think we're going to get the best science advice, despite the efforts of the Centre for Science and Policy to bring scientists to policy. It's a real worry. I just want to talk about a couple of examples then of what progress was made in the Select Committee. And I have to say it's really only in the Select Committee that this progress has been made, because I feel we've gone backwards in terms of independent science advice. There was a report which you can look at on independent science on science advice in government, which made a number of recommendations about the importance of respecting internal science advice. We also did a report on abortion, and I used the opportunity of that report on the science of the law on abortion, that is the question of the threshold of fetal viability, to use that opportunity to explain for the first time ever in a report why one requires to look at peer-reviewed published evidence and give that a higher standing in whether you consider there to be strong evidence for one proposition or another than unpublished work, or mere opinion. Okay, and that was, you know, it was a struggle to get some members of the committee to understand that, let alone members of Parliament. And secondly, that people need to declare conflicts of interest when providing advice to Parliament. And we had a number of doctors, writing in outside their expertise without saying that they came from a particular religious campaigning organisation, and seeking to have their evidence compared with people, an MRC-funded study by the college that had been peer-reviewed and published. And we did manage to expose that. The second thing we did, the second major advance, was in our report on homeopathy and the government's policy on homeopathy, published in March. And in fact, Chris Tyler, who's the director of the centre here, was heavily involved in that. I don't know if behind the scenes is the right word, but did a huge amount of work on all these reports. And what that did for the first time was explain to MPs the nature of what constitutes better evidence than some other evidence. So we explained that in contentious questions it's important to look at systematic reviews, particularly in the biosciences where this is possible. So that randomised controlled trials, where they existed, were often, in many cases, particularly in this field, were very good examples of evidence, but that you needed to then look at those systematically and grade them with clear criteria in advance. And then, when you have systematic reviews, you need to check whether the systematic reviews have been done in an appropriate way, because each faction, or the pro-homeopathy faction, cites a systematic review that they think agrees with them, when of course it doesn't. So we were able to do that, and I think that was real progress if we can get that driven home to more MPs. Finally, really, I just wanted to talk about the importance of front foot campaigning on science issues. For far too long, I found, and this was certainly true when I was first in Parliament, science was on the back foot, always having to defend the right to do embryo research, always having to defend the need for some research to be done, albeit very carefully regulated, using animals, particularly in biomedical research. Being on the back foot on anything that involved the word genetic, and having to almost apologise and say don't worry, and say that of course the precautionary principle, which is probably the wrong term, what should be the precautionary approach, shouldn't be overused. And what I think first happened was on embryo research, where after I put down a 10-minute rule bill that proved to the government that unless they did something they wouldn't be able to allow, they wouldn't be able to get the regulations through that would permit therapeutic cloning required for stem cell research, we got clinicians and patients together in an organised way and made sure that they presented their arguments to the press. And we had a pro, and in the embryology bill, we had a demonstration of scientists outside Parliament. Obviously, we didn't have the horses and cows' heads that the other side were wearing, but the power of white coats in the media is very effective, and we had slogans that were the equivalent of "get your rosaries off our ovaries" to do with embryo. I can't even remember. There was a very convoluted rhyme. And that's moved on now, of course, because scientists have got heavily engaged on the front foot in terms of calling for libel reform and have achieved our aims in the last Parliament of getting manifesto commitments from all the parties for libel reform to protect, among other things, scientific criticism. And the recent Science is Vital campaign, for which there was a large contingent in from Cambridge, also appears to have had a significant effect in showing that there is a case to be made for science. And the key thing about some of these grassroots campaigns is, and this is what I'm hoping to do outside Parliament for a while anyway, is show that there is a consequence to politicians for taking a position that is not rational or is not evidence-based. Because for most of my career in Parliament, I got all the letters from the antis on all of the issues I've talked about, and very little from the other side. And so there's huge pressure for them to take a position, MPs that they then can't work back from without being accused of being inconsistent, and they don't see any political advantage. And I don't believe everything should be based on plebiscite, but it can't do any harm for people engaged, and there must be up to 1 million people somehow engaged in science and evidence, to be able to say that there is a political consequence for MPs that don't take that view. So what do we need? And this is what I hope Julian will respond and see how we together, both inside and outside Parliament, can achieve this. Do we need more scientists in Parliament? Yes, but I don't think that's essential for our ends. Because no scientists are specialised now, and there's no reason to believe that a scientist is particularly good in another area of policy around science. What is required, ideally, is an understanding by as many MPs as possible of the scientific method, some of the issues that I've talked about, the nature of scientific inquiry, the continual organised scepticism, the need to publish in peer-reviewed journals. But even if that can't be got across, because sometimes you can lead a horse to water, you can't make it drink. You can't lead MPs to training in these areas, as Julian found out, at least in large numbers. Can we persuade policymakers to take advice, to know that they need to take advice on questions where evidence has a bearing, which is not every policy, of course, and it's not only the only issue one should take into account? Or even if we can't persuade them to always do that, to at least respect evidence and the scientific process, and not to diss it as just another form of fundamentalism, which is a fundamental, excuse the pun, failure to understand what science is all about. So a little bit of progress within Parliament, significant progress in sceptical and scientific activism outside Parliament, which I hope to be able to build on, but huge risks that the language of evidence-based policy will be polluted and will be back before square one, because we'll be having to argue not whether evidence is being used, but argue with people who claim that their policy is evidence-based. I think we will have in all parties more Milburns and Hewitts, and part of what I hope to do is, with the media and the community at large, the hundreds of thousands of them who I hope will all move to Oxford in time for the next election, is make sure that there's a political price to be paid for getting these things wrong. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Evan. I've written down at least 7 questions as a result of that. There will be time for all of you to ask Evan and indeed Julian some questions afterwards. Julian's going to be responding. Just a very brief intro to Julian, who was elected, as Evan said, to become the Cambridge City representative earlier this year. He's a scientist in biological chemistry, and I think you described, Julian, in your maiden speech which particular bit of genetics you were in, but I can't remember. It's something about triple-stranded DNA or something very, very weird. The only other thing that I remember from your maiden speech was pointing out that Rome and Cambridge were built on 7 hills, which was almost as obscure, I think, as the, as the DNA. I think that I'm not going to get in the way. Here's Julian. Come on, up you get.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to know some bits of that speech stuck. I think there are one or two other bits where Cambridge is a great place to be an MP for, particularly if you combine the university seat with the actual borough seat. There's been quite a lot of very interesting people who are MPs. Great scientists such as Isaac Newton. And great political reformers such as Cromwell. You may not agree with all of his reforms, but you know he really was quite an interesting reformer. And of course, great MPs more recently, such as David. And it's great to have him here. I've certainly found somehow I've ended up having to follow on from David and to follow on from Evan as well at the same time, while being neither a lawyer nor a medical doctor, and having I like to think a few ideas of my own, but. But it's been a very interesting time trying to follow both of them. When I agreed to respond to what Evan said, what I failed to realise is that means, of course, all the best jokes he's already taken. So if you just add to, you know, whatever you think of my speech, the extra jokes, and, you know, think of it like that. It's been a bit bizarre. When I got to Parliament, various people told me what it was like. In fact, Evan and David, among others, and I didn't believe them because there was no way it could be that ridiculous. Turns out I should have listened to them more. It really is a truly absurd place in all sorts of different ways. And rather than talk about all of the sort of weirdnesses, the role that prayers play in all sorts of things, whether you pray for some things, you pray against other things in completely different contexts. I'll just talk about what it's like coming in as a bit of a scientist into this weird building as well, which is sort of, depending how old you are, is either Gormenghast or Hogwarts. So, very strange place. There are, as I think was mentioned, 2 science PhDs in the House of Commons, myself and Therese Coffey from Suffolk Coastal. Those we've discovered recently on various ethical issues, we take different positions. We at least, share a scientific interest. But one shouldn't stop there. There are also people without science PhDs who get science. People like Evan, who is missed by everybody in the House who knows anything about science. But there are lots of people who get it. Then there's a chunk of people who one might think of as a sort of 2 cultures people who just don't understand it. And they're a bit of a problem. How do you deal with those? But you have the same problem here in Cambridge. Then you have the group of people I hadn't really come across before, which is the people who are actively anti-science. It's not that they don't get it. It's not that they missed it when they were at school. It's that they hate it. And I could give lots of examples. I mean, Nadine Dorries has been mentioned before. There's another Conservative MP who stopped me in the lobby once and said, "You shouldn't care about evidence. You should just know what's right." it would make papers a lot easier, actually. It could have gone a lot more out. And then there's David Tredinnick, who really is in a class of his own. I mean, I was tempted not to mention him because Evan did speak about him, but he's really that bad. He is really spectacular. The speech he gave about surgeons and blood clotting wasn't just a random place somewhere. It was in the House of Commons chamber. You know, he should have checked what he was saying. You could look it up. You probably don't believe what we're saying that he said, but it really is true. He and I have fought a bit on homeopathy. Recently, where he tabled a series of early day motions. These are a particularly weird and wonderful thing that the House of Commons has, where you can table these motions for debate and discussion. It's just that they will never, ever be debated or discussed or voted on in any way, shape or form, ever. But we spend £1 million a year or something printing them. So it's, good thing to do. But he tabled a series of them on homeopathy, looking at various papers showing that homeopathy worked. That's quite interesting. And actually, this is one of the things that showed the power of Twitter, which is something I use quite a bit, and Evan and I interacted quite a bit on this, and just asked the community at large, who are sad enough to follow us, can you have a look at these papers and say what's going on? And pretty quickly people looked at the original papers and found all sorts of glaring holes. One of the papers was comparing homeopathy to placebo and showing that homeopathy was not worse than placebo. You may notice that's not the same as saying it's better. And there was a series of others. There was one which was particularly interesting, which showed, which got away from the whole idea of placebo and showed that homeopathic remedies, I can't remember exactly what it was, and remedy is perhaps not the word to use, killed cancer cells. That's quite interesting. You know, it's not going to be a psychological thing. And somebody had to look through the paper in detail and found that what they had compared was saline solution, I think it was also some sort of aqueous solution, with concentrated alcohol with a bit of homeopathic remedy. And there's an important control here that wasn't done. And actually, in that case, it was, we actually found, I can't remember who it was who found this, there's probably somebody here who can remember, one of the authors who said that they had asked not to be on that paper because they were worried that it was not scientifically valid. Tells you something about the regard for it. Following on from that idea, you know, it turns out that if you cover bullets with a bit of homeopathic remedy, they're still effective at shooting people. So, despite all of this, there was this fantastic report which the Science and Technology Select Committee did on homeopathy. It's a big, thick thing, and I think it really demolishes some of the people who came to argue for homeopathy. Despite that, you may not know that the government funds, I think, 4 homeopathic hospitals and lots of homeopathic remedies. There's millions of pounds spent on this. And the Health Secretary decided recently to continue doing this. This was a good use of NHS money. You may remember that there's some cuts happening in various areas. If you can think of where you would prioritise cuts, think of whatever it is you disagree with and compare it to this. So if any of you happen to live in South Cambridgeshire and you would like to talk to your MP about this, you know, just an idea. So there's things like that. I should say there's also some issues with journalism. I mean, Evan touched on statistics. I remember, I forget her name now, in London, one of the London radio journalists who was talking about MMR. And said, I can't remember the figures, 1 in 10 children without it would get measles. So well, why not just vaccinate that one? Why do the others? and it goes on that the government is currently running an active anti-chemist campaign. Because the term chemist is used to mean people who make drugs. And so there is an active campaign of, you know, just, you know, say no to chemists. So we have some problems with that. I should say, by the way, in what I say, I'll talk about science quite a bit. I don't mean science in the sort of purest sense of science. I do count things like engineering, humanities, even some of the less evidence-based things like medicine, I think do fit in, and things to do with IT, because there are problems with understanding of technology as well, and it's part of that broader area. There was a lot of discussion about the Digital Economy Act before the last election, which is another topic in itself. But the minister at one point was talking about the IP address of a computer and explained that IP stood for intellectual property. Not in that case. So there are some problems with these people, and it's a bit terrifying. And we're in a coalition, so I'm supposed to say nice things about Conservatives at the moment. And one thing which they had in their manifesto, which we didn't have in ours, but was a really good idea, was a compulsory course for MPs about basics of science. It was a really good idea. And unfortunately got a bit watered down by the time the actual election happened. So it went from being a compulsory course for all MPs to a one-hour seminar with anybody who showed up. And the problem with that really was that the people who showed up were people like me. They were people like George Freeman, who some of you, I think, will know, who's MP for Mid-Norfolk. It was the people who understood a bit about science already. And it wasn't the others, who were the ones we actually wanted to come to the seminar. But it was a good idea. And there are some good people. David Willetts wasn't involved in the science space before the election, but actually he's been pretty good. I wouldn't say he's been ideal, I wouldn't say he's been perfect. You know, Evan as science minister would have been much more exciting. But David Willetts does show signs of getting it and being pretty good on some of these things. And there are some real areas of scientific expertise in and around Parliament. So there's things like the Parliamentary Office of Science and Technology, POST. There's a Science and Technology Select Committee. There are, in government, the Chief Scientific Advisers. And all of those do play a critical role. The question is how much they're actually listened to. So one of the things I spent some time doing just before the summer recess was to ask every single department, how often have your ministers met with your Chief Scientific Advisor? What was interesting, this is not a hard question to answer. You know, diaries are kept. I'm still waiting for some of the answers because it's too hard to work it out. In several cases where I have managed to find out the dates of these meetings, what's happened, for the Home Secretary, for example, took several months to answer and then revealed that she had in fact met the Chief Scientific Advisor once, the day before answering the question. So, and there are some departments where they're very clearly saying, we haven't. There are some, in fairness, where they clearly do talk regularly to their CSA, and that's really good. There are some, the Prime Minister refused to answer the question. Don't quite know why it was so sensitive. Have you spoken to him? But there are problems there. And there's a particular problem because every department has a CSA, with a few exceptions, some understandable exceptions. The law officers, they don't have a chief scientific advisor. That's fine. Their job is to do law. I can understand they're quite a small department. The only big one that doesn't have one is the Treasury. And I and others for a while have been trying to persuade the Treasury that it should have a chief scientific advisor. The response from the Treasury has been, but why would we need a chief scientific advisor? And I keep saying, that's the point. You're asking that question is why you need one. And then you'd understand that science actually does have something to contribute to, you know, the economy. So that's a constant pressure. On the subject of money, rather than go back through what's happened in the past, as Evan sort of did, I'm going to try and talk about what's happening at the moment and maybe a little about where it's going. So I ought to say a little bit about the science funding and the budget and the cash freeze that we managed to get. And actually the cash freeze, you know, it's not ideal. We'd have all liked rather more money. But it's actually a really good result, particularly when compared to what it was going to be only a few weeks before the budget, before the CSR. And there are lots of reasons why it was so good and so much better than so many other departments. And really it comes down to the fact the science community stuck together and had a good message, a simple message, and a well-evidenced message. So the learned societies were there making a joint case, talking to each other, with very little saying, well, obviously you don't want to give money to the chemists, but you should give it to these people. Then there was the grassroots organisation, Science is Vital, had this fantastic campaign of petition, of a lobby of Parliament, of a march, of getting Evan to sing songs outside the Treasury and, you know, not stop until they put some more money in. It was really a fantastic thing. Plus, of course, there was all the economic evidence that had been collected over so long. The fact that investment in science really does pay back. And that was really good. And then actually, in the slightly silly way these things end up, until the Sunday evening before the CSR, it was still going to be a cut in cash terms for science. And the story I'm told is that the quartet, Cameron, Osborne, Danny Alexander and Nick Clegg, were at Chequers, and they got a phone call that said, from the Treasury, saying, we've redone the calculations, there's a spare £200 million. And Nick said, and I like to think it's because I've been annoying him about this for so long, let's just put it all into science, it'll keep them happy. And so that's how it went from being a roughly £200 million cut to a freeze, slightly randomly. But all the rest of it really played a difference. I'll come back to that in a second. Talking about money, I should probably say a little bit about teaching money, which is what's happening to universities and tuition fees. I have a slight problem because I've promised our chief whip that I won't say anything publicly about tuition fees. So I'm going to be very careful what I say. What I will say is I gave a talk last night to the Cambridge Student Liberal Democrats about Trident and the policy of MAD. And, you know, that's entirely unrelated to this, of course. But the teaching budget is very important. But actually, we need to look at what happens about science teaching, not just at universities, but also back at schools. Because there is a desperate shortage of proper science teachers who actually know what they are talking about. And teachers of any subject can make a huge difference to their pupils and what they go on to do. And we know, particularly in physics, there is a desperate shortage. And there's a cycle that causes. You don't have proper physics teachers, people don't study physics, they don't go on to study physics at university, they don't go back and become physics teachers, and you keep going, you keep in this decline. And we have to look much broader than just what happens to people studying STEM subjects at university. It goes back a lot earlier than that. The other thing that's happening, which will have a huge effect in this area, as well as money, and as well as anything else that happens in terms of domestic policy, is what's happening with immigration. In an effort to show that I can talk about things other than science in the House of Commons, I'm on the Home Affairs Select Committee. It deals with policing, counter-terrorism, all these sort of light-hearted activities. We're also dealing at the moment with the government's proposed immigration cap. And you'll probably know that they have an idea to reduce the number of people coming from outside the EU. One could argue whether this is for sensible reasons or for xenophobic reasons. Again, I won't go into that. But the idea is to reduce net immigration from hundreds of thousands to tens of thousands. And the first target on that is Tier 1 and Tier 2 entry, so skilled workers. And a lot of those include people here, whether they're in companies, whether they're in the university. And it is a huge problem for the organisations I talk to. I'm sure many of you would have experienced it. And there is very shortly to be made a decision about how much to clamp down on it and how much not to allow skilled people to come in. It's going to be very tight, and we'll have to see how it goes and how we manage to keep science going, because science is an international activity. We do need to have an exchange, and just because somebody comes from America or South Africa or China or India doesn't mean they shouldn't be able to come here as an academic. We'll see where we get on that. I've been doing some things. You may be interested to know there's a special exemption from this very tight cap for elite sports people and ministers of religion, but not for, you know, doctors, scientists, engineers. If that isn't changed, I think it'll be a very worrying statement about what the government thinks drives our country. So I hope that there'll be some flexibility on that. It's also very shortly going to start hitting students. There is a belief that students are flooding in, coming to bogus colleges, and some of that is indeed true, but it's increasingly going to hit students coming from outside the EU who want to come and study in Cambridge or anything like that, and that's going to become a real problem. I already talk to senior tutors who tell me of the great problems getting students to come in. They constantly have issues, and that's going to be the next big worry there. But it's not all bad. I mean, some of the things that are happening are quite good, and I do think the government understands a bit, at least, of the role that innovation plays. That we need to go a bit further. And I always think that what is our economic future going to be? What will Britain be doing in 2050 that will be of value to the rest of the world? I don't think it's going to be banking. I think we'll struggle to say we're just the bankers to the world for the next 40 years. I can't see it being basic manufacturing. I can't see it being agriculture. If it's going to be anything, surely it's going to be about knowledge, about high-tech industry, about science, about research, about all of these things. And we have to do what we can to support that. And there are colleagues, I mentioned George Freeman earlier, Conservative from Mid-Norfolk, and he and I are trying to do some cross-party work on this. We've written an article called The Appliance of Science, which is available in selected newspapers near you, including the Cambridge News, trying to push for that, to try to see our way through to saying this is something that has to be prioritised. And some of that's come out in things like technology innovation centres, whether those are the sort of Fraunhofer type model from Germany about focus on improving small and medium enterprises, or the Hauser lighthouse style. It's interesting to see the language change. There is a sense that we do need to try to promote this, to actually turn some of the great knowledge that we have into great products and actually feed back into the economy. Probably spoken for long enough, and hopefully enough to stimulate some questions. Just a few sort of thoughts on what, as a community, we all need to be doing. I think one of the things, just to make sure that science counts and is heard, and that we make sure that people are listening. I think things like Science is Vital have played a huge role in that. We need to make sure that the messages that we're coming out with for politicians and for journalists, people in that space, are understandable. And we also need to make sure that it's available, that when a journalist or when a politician wants to know something, they know who to ask and how to find out from them what's going on. If we make sure that that happens, we make sure that politicians know that there is a community that cares about this, that might even vote based on whether people say sensible things, then I think we'll be going forward quite a long way. Thank you.
Right, well, we've got a wonderful opportunity now to do some Q&A. Whilst we're getting ourselves assembled, one of the things that came into my mind from both Evelyn and Julian were speaking was a quote that I heard a spokesperson from the White House say, or was reported in a press release, after George Bush had been elected for the first time, and they were responding to a long petition by a bunch of climate change experts on saying that his refusal to sign the Kyoto, or negating Clinton's signing the Kyoto thing, was bad. And the spokesperson's immortal words were, "The trouble with these scientists is they think they're smarter than the average American." Yeah. And in there is, I think, part of the elephant in the room. And the elephant in the room, I saw a little bit of its trunk and maybe a little bit of its tail in the discussions just now, but it's the media. And anybody who watches In the Loop or anything like that will understand what the pressures are. And what you didn't really touch on, I mean, both of you touched on to some extent the civil service and the CSAs and the relationship with ministers and with Parliament, but you didn't talk about the media. And was that a deliberate omission or was that something else? Evan?
Well, it's a subject all on its own, worthy of more than one book. In fact, there's a couple that have already been written about bad science in the media. But I don't accept... So, yes, there's an issue, and science journalists are variable from poor to good, and the good have got better, but the political journalists reporting science aren't much good. I don't think we're going to easily change the media, and I don't think that's the priority, actually. I'm a free speech person, and I've got other priorities in that area. So I don't think we should tolerate a politician saying, I can't do this because of the media, because... we demonstrated, and I think Alistair Kent's here, who was one of the people involved in that embryology bill work, that even though the tabloid media might be seen to be against hybrid embryos, which is even worse than hybrid crops, genetically speaking, as far as the media was concerned, you can overcome that on condition. So what? I mean, I think it's unsatisfactory that this is the case, but politicians find it difficult to argue both against the tabloid media and the opposition. Okay, and if you can neutralise the media or get the opposition on board, then that's helpful, and that's where a lot of my focus was in the last few years, was trying to make sure that there wasn't organised party politics brought in on behalf of the Daily Mail, which was not always easy with the Conservatives in opposition, but there's a real opportunity with the Labour Party in opposition, that they'll become rational, more rational, on some of these issues. So I don't think we can cure the media, but I don't think we have to if we can do some of the other things better. And governments, I don't think, should be allowed to get off the hook by saying, oh, they're going to upset the Daily Mail. We see it in drugs, but I see Gabriel Horne here, in fact, and we know that in drugs policy this is a problem. Mm. But it was a particular problem for the last government because the Conservatives in opposition wanted to sack scientists even before they'd given their advice, not after, scientific advisers. So I think, again, the role of the opposition in this Parliament is very important, as well, of course, the role of the Liberal Democrats, for whom we happen to be from, in government. And so I'm more... there's less of an excuse for this government, if I can put it like that.
Julian?
I was curious which election it was where Bush was elected. I mean, the first one...
The first one. This was just after the first one.
I remember having a bumper sticker for the second one saying, re-defeat Bush. But I think in terms of dealing with media... It is an important
thing. We don't live in a rational world.
it is an important thing to do. I touched on it very briefly, partly because I didn't think everybody wanted to be here for 24 hours while we discussed every single thing that there is here. We have to have better science journalists, but actually it's not so much the quality of the science journalists that's a problem, it's the fact that they're not consulted by the other journalists, and actually they don't have the chance to put in their comments, and I know from talking to some of them that they are horrified by the stuff that they see go out in their own newspapers, their own televisions. So there is something about getting more people in, getting more journalists to understand. You know, maybe all journalists should have this basic crash course in science that we do for MPs. But then part of it is also thinking more carefully about how we get our messages out. And, you know, what is it that the Daily Mail likes and what messages can we give that will fit in with their agenda? Can we come up with something like that? Or occasionally just confuse them. You know, there's the great problem they're having at the moment with the idea that immigration cap, they want to stop foreigners coming into this country, but some of these foreigners are working to cure cancer. Which side are they on that argument? And suddenly they're not quite sure what to do, and there's a space for a bit of rationality. You know, foreigners curing cancer is a good story. And, you know, trying to understand what is it that motivates them. And there are a lot of things where there is more than one argument for doing something. And this is more, I think, for politicians. What is the argument that you can give to the Daily Mail that will persuade them of something? Give them arguments about economic benefits of having sort of people coming in. Tell them it's a business. And then they might be interested. Tell them it's just, you know, it's an important liberal cause and they won't care.
Thank you. We've got first question down here. Jackie's coming down with a microphone. Right, and if in the interests of making sure that there's impartiality here, if you give your name and affiliation.
Hi, Dan.
My name is Tom Brown. I'd like to say something about the media from a slightly different point of view, but I think that is relevant. About 5 years ago, I was asked to be the chairman of a Royal Society working group on terrorism, use of science against terrorism. And we put out a report and we suggested a number of things that the government might do, many of which they took up. But one of the points that we made is that the greatest fear of terrorism was fear itself, that the likelihood of being caught in a terrorist incident was really very small and much less than being run over by a car, and that the media played a large role in this. When we presented our report in front of many representatives of the media, they more or less said to us, don't be stupid, we're interested in selling newspapers. We want to whip up terror. And so I think that's part of the problem. You've been saying here we need to explain the science clearly, but that's not the criterion that the media is interested in.
Who's going to respond to that
first?
Just
reiterate my point, and I think, this is something I've learned, that I think it's enough of a job to focus on the politicians. There is a lot of work going on in fisking bad science in the newspapers, and yes, there's an argument that actively misleading people should be a PCC issue, but obviously only if you're involved in the story can you make a complaint, and that's a problem. But in the end, that's such a huge task that I suspect will never be won, okay, despite the efforts that have been made, that what we need to do is ensure that the journalists have the scientific view put across, that the Science Media Centre does act as a vector to do that very effectively. But in the end, our job is to explain that evidence-based policy means not deferring to the views of tabloid editors and being tough enough to tough it out. And there are enough examples where they do that for us not to... I just think it's an unwinnable battle. And as I say, Julian said that he couldn't even get MPs, a captive population, to training, let alone, unless you did it in a pub over lunch many times. It's just not... So I've learnt that that's not a battle worth fighting full on. Go round them. Other people are doing the work. I would urge any Huppert family member to concentrate on policy makers.
Does the Huppert family member wish to comment on that?
Yes, I feel I also declare an interest at this point. Strict rules about these things. The one thing I'd add is that knowing what the media are looking for just tells you a bit more about how you should present the story, that there are scientific stories where actually there is something really exciting about it. And if you give them a dull story, if they have to publish it, they'll try and swing it in some weird and wonderful way. If there's actually something interesting there, tell them the interesting, true thing. Make it, journalists are fundamentally lazy, really lazy. And the best way to get them to print something, typically, is to send them something perfectly formatted, so all they have to do is to copy and paste. And if you make that interesting enough, then that's all they'll do.
My colleague exempts the local Cambridge press. He told me earlier that he meant everyone other than that.
We got a bother.
Is anybody here from the Cambridge News?
Well, they're not going to admit it now.
So we sent them a press release earlier.
I'm too lazy to come.
Barbara.
Barbara Sahakian, thank you very much for your comments and for promoting science. I think it's obviously extremely important both for the economy but also for the mental capital of the country. So really, my question is this, that I think we've failed our youth to some extent with the recession that we've got ourselves into and without being able to offer them a really good future. I think we need to put more money into training our own scientists here because we don't put enough money into training. We get many fine students who want to come to the University of Cambridge to do graduate studies, and we just simply don't have enough grants for them. So I would prefer to see that we do some of our own training. I realize science is a global activity, but I think we should be training more of our own scientists. And rather than simply importing people. And that may be providing a better future for our own people and better mental capital in the future.
Comment on
well,
that.
I think we need to do both. I mean, you know, I would love to see more funding available for more master's studentships, more doctoral studentships, coping with the fact that as more PhDs become four-year programmes rather than three-year programmes, they cost that bit more. So you end up with fewer of them. So we should be doing that as well as make it possible for people to move in and out. You know, I don't see why we can't do both.
I think there's a huge amount of more work that could and should be done on scientific careers in policy in Parliament. I was on Select Committee for years and years, and there was never a proper inquiry into scientific careers. I raised it every session, and I never managed to get it taken up. I tried to raise the question of women in science, and not one of the men on the Science Committee, and they were all men, agreed that this was well, it didn't show. So it was there in spirit, I suppose. But the point I would make is that there needs to be some thought given to this continual problem of the glass ceiling for women, in other words, the pipeline, which is leaky, being even more leaky for women. The fact that I think the shape of the pyramid is wrong, that there's people who spend a lot of time learning research techniques, doing the doctorate, learning how the lab works, doing a lot of the teaching in the lab, and then finding they can't get that next postdoc place, or their career depends on the success of a grant application of someone other than them, or that there isn't a suitable postdoc place for their partner, the two-body problem. None of these issues have ever been looked at in Parliament. And whenever people get together to discuss it, the Royal Society does it, it's always, you never get the voice of the career, young career scientist on the platform, which is outrageous, and it infuriates me every time I see it. So I'm hoping, just heard it here first, to move science is vital into that area, because I think there's a huge opportunity to put pressure on, particularly given the cutbacks in funding, because of flat cash settlement, it does have cutbacks, and I just don't think we should be spending money on training people who will never be able to use that. It's a good thing, but I'd far rather make sure there were posts for people to progress into, and that we did a proper analysis of every person, particularly women, who leave science and academia. Exit interviews should be done by every funder. The responsibilities on the public funders to do this. Anyway, I'm on a soapbox here.
Right.
You provoked me.
If you're on a soapbox, I'm going to just join in. Just one thing, that a little advert for the Centre for Science and Policy. We have, as part of our activities, a professional development programme, which is taking scientists and demonstrating to them how they can work with policymakers, and that there is a career into public policy. But even somewhat more substantial than that, David Howarth and I and Andrew Gamble are working on a Masters in Public Policy, which with any luck will be launched in October 2012, which may well, with any luck, lead to the formation of a School of Government here in Cambridge. But we are very serious about doing that. And if anybody is interested in supporting that, of course, we'd like to hear from them. Gabriel, you're next.
Gabriel Horne, I support what you're proposing just now. I think it's a great idea. But I wanted to, if I might, go back to this issue of the general parliamentarian coming to a deeper understanding of science and therefore affecting the way that the policies of this country run. Over the last 10 years or so, a lot of effort was put into placing chief scientific advisors into various departments. And you know about that. And you know, of course, that Treasury has resisted it, although a number of us have tried to put pressure on Treasury to do something about it, but it was always the ears were both deaf to it. Now, given that largely that effort has been successful and most departments do have chief scientific advisors, and Julian, you said they play a critical role. That was your word, they're critical, you say. And on the other hand, it appears that they are not being consulted. And the third point is, you also say that there should be some system by which parliamentarians can consult. Well, this is where I'm mystified, because there is a system through which they can consult. There's also, of course, a chief scientific advisor. And it seems they're not consulting. So where is this paradox to be resolved? I think it's to do with the education of the parliamentarians. That's from school days. That's what I suspect is at issue here. But I would like to hear what you have to say about those things.
I mean, I think part of the issue is there's a distinction between parliament and government.
Yeah.
And so as an MP, it's relatively hard for me to go and just see a departmental CSA. You have to sort of arrange to accidentally meet somewhere randomly while actually doing something else. And so, you know, those sort of links just aren't there. That CSAs are not chief scientific advisors not available for MPs to ask questions of. You just simply can't do it that way. I think actually part of the answer is in finding a way, perhaps, of educating researchers. Because trying to get MPs to do anything is quite a challenge. But the other option is to say, there are all these researchers working for the MPs, and they actually do a lot of the writing of speeches, for example. And there's a certain amount where a researcher writes a speech, and an MP reads it out. There was an instance, I should be very careful here and not say which minister it was, who accidentally announced a policy recently, where it seems they had no idea what it was. None of the other ministers did, but some speechwriter had inserted this particular issue into the speech. So it's now government policy, and we're now trying to get them to roll back from it. And that happens in government, but that also happens at all levels. And you can see that fairly obviously. Evan would never, ever do that, of course. But
I presume it's free schools and that nonsense.
I'll tell you later. But so educating some of the researchers would make a difference, that even if you get only a few of those people to understand a bit more, then actually it almost doesn't matter sometimes if their MP doesn't understand it. If they read out the right words and they vote the right way, you've got halfway there.
Do you have anything to say?
I'm giving some thought to how this can be done from outside Parliament. Julian's quite right that one has to separate out the executive. And I want to see evidence that merely having science advisers is of significant benefit. It's something we called for, but I never thought that just having a name or a person, and if they weren't properly used or weren't assertive themselves, and it's not clear to me. And the role of the chief science advisor is important, and in recent times they have all been, and the current one is, complex personalities. Let me put it like that, in a complex role. So there's a whole separate issue about science in government. The title of the talk was Science in Parliament, and in my view, what I'm looking at doing with my organisation is providing essentially a parliamentary fact check service, whereby immediately fact checks will be exposed and hopefully publicised with carrot and stick for good and bad, and therefore evolve to somewhere where we offer a pre-open your mouth service, where we can, if someone wants to table something like an early day motion, which, although it's pointless in parliamentary terms, has relevance in saying this is what I say, think terms, and speeches as well. So there's stuff that can be done to provide positive support and also expose it, because merely repeating anecdotes here is fun, but it doesn't change behaviour, and we need to find a way of doing that. And the internet is powerful. If we can get a few hundred people in each constituency to protest at what an MP does from a scientific point of view, politely and constructively, and in the general election, to candidates slightly less politely and potentially destructively, then I think we can change behaviour for the better. That's a project.
Now, we're getting to the moment in an evening that every chair dreads. I have at least five questions stacked up, and I've just had what I regard as a priority interrupt, because we have a deputy chief scientific advisor sitting in the audience who put his hand up. Miranda, Miles, and I'm going to ask everybody now to be brief, both in question and answer. Thank you.
Thanks, Miles Parker, and I am indeed deputy chief scientific advisor in DEFRA. But what I wanted to come back on was Gabriel's last question, which was about support to parliamentarians in scientific issues. POST was set up on the model of the OTA in Congress, but is a pale imitation. When I and my colleagues, and I'm about to set up a hostage to fortune here, when I and my colleagues go to the parliamentary select committees on science and technology, we are challenged politely. It's a good conversation, but it is not the sort of forensic savagery that my other colleagues get when they go to the other select committees, which are more determined, if you like, on blood. I think you'll get more of an interaction if it is not just the Science and Technology Committees that are attacking chief scientific advisors, but if science is part of those other select committees and can actually make senior policymakers realise that science is a significant part of what they do. But my question ultimately is, could we not strengthen the support to MPs on science matters, strengthen posts, strengthen the library and so forth?
I'll take note of the fact that you'd like more forensic savagery, and do let me know next time you're appearing before Science and Technology, and I'm sure there will be people who can oblige. I mean, just for what it's worth, I'm on, as I said, on the Home Affairs Select Committee, and I've been trying, I think, finally successfully to get the Home Office Chief Scientific Advisor to come before the committee. It took, again, a bit of effort to persuade people why this would be an interesting witness. Why would your Chief Scientific Advisor have something interesting to say? Well, if they don't, you really haven't got a very good chief scientific advisor. In this case, I think he's a very interesting character. In terms of strengthening posts, I think part of the problem is the timeliness. And I mean, I'm recently elected to the board of POST, which I think Evan was on before. And my major concern would be that it's a fantastic organisation, does very good unbiased work, but it takes 3 to 6 months to do a piece of work. And the problem is that the parliamentary cycle is typically, here is something, I need an answer within the next 10 minutes because I'm then speaking about it. And so while, you know, an overnight fact check, as Evan's talking about, is fantastically useful, not least for people like me, because I simply can't, you know, check all the things at all. And POST is just a bit slow on some of these things. So when it knows that there is an issue coming up in 6 months or a year, it can do some really very good work towards it. It's just that sometimes we need something now.
Evan, comment on it?
I've got views on POST, which I don't really want to be podcast. So, because there is, I think I have no basis to say this from my time within POST, that it's under threat in terms of funding, because it's a standalone, and I'm sure the library will want to absorb it. And what many people would like to see is something that is as exactly as you said, something modelled on the congressional office, which it isn't, and there's some really good people in there, but I didn't get it, and I didn't do a huge amount on this to try and get it to be more responsive, though I did make a number of suggestions. So that is an option if it survives in its current form and can be made to be more nimble on its feet, but it is reluctant. It's pity because it needn't be reluctant to critique what MPs say. I'd have thought that's not unreasonable. But anyway, my organisation would be happy to do that if they don't. I'm surprised what you say about the... I can only speak for the Science and Technology Committee when I when they came before me, and John Beddington didn't like coming before us because we'd always raise something that was awkward for him. Not because he didn't know his stuff, but we would raise... not scientific nonsense done by the government, and he in his early days found that more difficult than he does now to dissociate himself from. But the worry would be that if chief science advisors went before other committees, they get much more politics, and I think that would be a good thing, because they should then say to MP, you don't understand, okay, that's not the way we do it, and that would be beneficial. But If you report that the Science and Technology Committee, while I sat on it, was too friendly, then and that's noted. But in the end, it shouldn't be adversarial, in my view, unless you're dealing with politicians who refuse to answer the question. I think you could do perfectly good reports by not being adversarial and getting the answers that you need.
Right, I'm going to take two more questions. The first one, I think, is there. Michael.
Thanks, Michael Tyler. fairly quick question, but in two parts. We heard a lot about the transmitting and receiving of messages, if you like, about scientific advice by various players in the game, even science journalists. But what we didn't hear about was the transmitting of that evidence or advice by scientists. In fact, we had a lot of criticism of a number of players, from members of parliament to ministers to science journalists or non-science journalists failing to pay attention to their colleagues. What we didn't hear about is whether the scientific community is doing a good job or as good a job as it should in presenting that evidence to Parliament, to ministers, or even to the media alongside that. That was the first question. Then the second part is a more specific one, the functioning of select committees. While no particular admirer of the US Congress, I have seen very effective impact from congressional testimony by scientists, including the written testimony read into the record. And it seems to me that parliamentary select committees could do a better job, but I'd like to hear your view about that.
Now, let's deal with both of those quickly. The second one first. I was on the, with David, in fact, on the right committee that looked at the reform of Parliament, which was the first ever elected committee. We were elected by our peers with a small p. And one of the things that I was very keen to do and was not just have, was to have elected select committees so that they weren't party appointees, because you just don't get forensic questioning by all the government members or government ministers when they're appointed on the basis of their loyalty. And secondly, make sure that they were small enough so that they could be filled with enthusiasts, because it's no good having an election if it's not competitive. And this is the most important thing, and I went to a seminar by the chair of the Backbench Business Committee, which was something I was pleased to have a hand in setting up, and adds to my frustration in not being able to be there to deal with it. But that select committee reports can be debated on the specific recommendations should be debated on the floor of the House where the government doesn't respond adequately on a divisible motion, forcing the government to whip against a senior member of their own party chairing that committee. That would really give select committees credibility and therefore encourage MPs to do stuff. In terms of your first question, I am very cautious about asking scientists to do something that they don't already do in this respect. It is not required for scientists to change the. There are problems with peer review, and there's problems in terms of access and open access. I'm a believer in that in terms of publication. But the approach of peer review for funding, doing the work, peer review for publication, declaration of interests, not publishing, not announcing before you publish, all those things need to be kept tight. And I'm far more critical of. When there's a bad science story, I look to see at the institutional press release to see if the quotes in there or the claims made in there are what led the journalist astray, because they go beyond what's in the paper. And that is often the case, and I think that's much more criticisable, more egregious than, you know, the Daily Mail running with it, frankly. So I think it's essential for the integrity of the system that we keep scientists' behaviour tight, while accepting what Julian says, that there are effective ways of getting your message across, which and institutional press departments, Cambridge University, you know, press department, have scientifically trained people to do that, and the Science Media Centre also exists to help with that. So I don't think that's the problem, and I would be very cautious about asking people to be more flaky.
Brief response.
Well, I mean, select committees, I'm sure we could be better. I'm still trying to find my way around the ones I'm on at the moment, and I'm sure we could learn more. In terms of what scientists can do, I think there are two things which have started happening recently but simply didn't really happen before, I think. I get huge numbers of letters and emails every week, sort of hundreds and hundreds. I don't know the exact numbers at the moment. On any issue, there are organised campaigns from Greenpeace, from any other organisation, lobbying to get access to homeopathy, for example. You know, there are organised campaigns of people doing that. And, you know, it'd be good if scientists did some of that as well. And when there are issues where it is actually about the science, it's not just about values or morals or something, it's actually about scientific interpretation, to have organisations, and I hope Evans... group will be able to do this, where people who care can send a message to their MP to show that it matters. And I think the thing that's a step above that, and I'm always... I mean, I find it slightly hard to comment on this because in my constituency, and indeed at Evans, I think it's atypical. Knocking on doors here, you get scientists who talk to you about scientific issues and correct you on tiny little nuance of details as well. But what I would say, and particularly, in fact, only to people who don't live in Cambridge constituency, is go to see your MP at a constituency surgery. Don't in Cambridge, you know. But go and see them. Talk to them about issues that you care about that are to do with science. MPs will come and see you and have a message available in the 10, 15-minute slot that there is of what you want them to understand, because they will listen. Now, they might not immediately change their behaviour when you go and see them, but if there's a few people who go and see them, that actually has an effect, because while the emails and the letters are good, they don't actually—they're definitely helpful, but they don't show great commitment. Coming to see me, I take very seriously, shows that you've given up that time. So do go and see your MP and talk to them about what they're doing and why. As I say, unless you're in Cambridge, but particularly if you're in Oxford, West, and Abingdon.
I think you encouraged people to go to South Cambridgeshire earlier. We have a room for one more question. Finbar, you're next. Please. Brief responses.
Finbar Livesey. A quick comment. There's an ongoing contradiction in government. They claim science and innovation is core to growth and then want to ignore it. A pipe dream, wouldn't it be great to have a PCAS like in the States, which is a group of scientists equivalent to the Council of Economic Advisers who sees the Prime Minister and the Cabinet on a regular basis, and that would make a huge change, but it probably will never, ever happen in my lifetime. And then my actual question, how can we get more scientists to actually become MPs? The Royal Society report 4 or 5 months ago has an awful diagram for those who want to go into long-term academia, which shows 3.5% of PhDs granted in the UK go on to a tenured position. So we seem to have a lot of people with science training who could productively go into Parliament.
Brief responses, Julian? You're already there, so...
Well, I mean, to pick up that last one thing that you could do would be to help fund the campaigns of scientists who plan to stand, such as in Oxford West and Abingdon, and to encourage it. I mean, encourage people to go for it, actually, because I think, actually, putting the party politics aside, all parties are short of good candidates for parliamentary seats at the moment. You know, and that's obvious if you look around anywhere. Certainly if you spend much time in the House of Commons, it's clear that there's a certain amount of barrel. So encourage people to go for it. Whatever their political persuasions, encourage people to try. It's really good. There is a problem, as well in just the discourse, because scientists are actually quite good at saying, I don't know, or it depends on the evidence. And there is a real problem in politics that if you say that, it just looks like you don't care. And I've had this on some things where I say, well, it depends on this thing. If it's big, then that's a silly idea. If it's small, that's a great idea. People describe that as sitting on the fence. I describe it as waiting for evidence. So you have to adjust somewhat to that. But it would be fantastic to get more people who get science. They don't have to be scientists. They have to get science.
Emma, last word?
Well, that was very well put. And it's answers like that from Julian that make me recognise that he's at least... It took me 5 years to get where he is now after 5 months, I have to say, with these insights.
I had better advice, Joe.
Quite. Because I was just a doctor. a medical doctor. And I was too tired. So I agree with... I think that was a very effective answer. But I come back to the point, because I like to be... And I absolutely agree that most of the scientists who get on in politics abandon the scientific approach for ideology. There's nothing wrong with that, and some of them continue that. And that's why I don't think you can rely on scientists in Parliament, because I know plenty of people in Parliament with scientific degrees who are evidence averse. I won't give him his real name, but there's a guy called Dr. Fox, okay? With two X's, this one I'm talking about, who doesn't really... It's not relevant, so I just think that
he's not a scientist,
that's you. Well, indeed. I can come up with others. So it's not good enough to rely on that, in other words. I think that what I said before, to be consistent, that an understanding of the scientific method or the ability to seek and take scientific advice and or to have respect for evidence and understand, well, at least respect for the evidence, even if you don't understand why randomised control trial is better than an anecdote or an assertion, that's the approach to take in the short and medium term. And I would hope that we'd have a career structure that wouldn't have scientists who have a lot of money spent on them kicking around. We will never have a overwhelmingly scientific political class, and that wouldn't be the right approach. We have to get them to learn, to take advice, to seek advice, take advice, and understand on those policies where, and it's not every or many policies, where evidence is important, the nature of evidence and the nature of the scientific approach. And that's the challenge, I think, over the next few years. And what Julie and I have said about making there be a political consequence because of the number of people interested in this in constituencies is a challenge for us on the outside. And I hope we'll be able to rise to it.
Well, I've got to say that I have thoroughly enjoyed this evening the discussion, the presentations and the discussion afterwards. I apologise to the half a dozen so people who wanted to ask questions. All I can say at the end of that is it would be so much better if all our political representatives were of this high calibre.
All
thank
above
you very
average.
Much.
Yeah.